Okay, so we're back again, and again, just to acknowledge and appreciate the Buddhist community at Stanford for initiating this morning, and as is usually the case, they have to come up with a topic, and so of course came up with a wonderfully generic topic that I could talk about anything, reflections on the path, and you know, of course the reality is when we speak of path, it's this negotiating this thing we call life, thing we call our minds, and how to live within the world, and the world isn't just some abstract thing, entity out there. This is it's the world of people. Primarily, we have to live with people, but then, of course, people are set in a context of the conditions, the environment, the the weather, all of the forces of nature, and of course, one of the forces of nature is viruses. Came across a quote a while ago. I mentioned it to the community. I don't think I used it in a talk. Anyway, it was a scientist from some time ago, one of the early people who was studying viruses. And anyway, so there's a called virus, a piece of bad news wrapped in a protein. So it's that's what we got. We definitely have a virus wreaking havoc, and of course it doesn't really care about human beings. It's doing what a virus does, and it's actually quite successful at what it's doing. And these things go through cycles, in the same way that, say, in a storm of you have rain, and you might have lightning, and you know, for all of the lightning strikes that happen, it doesn't really affect humans all that much, but it's a part of nature, and sometimes it does. So that this is an occasion when the forces of nature are affecting us as human beings and as a society. And for much of things, we somewhat out of our control. But that being said, you know, what do we have some modicum of control over? And you know, you have a certain level of control over how we react internally, how we react externally, and in particular, this is where the Buddha gave many teachings on the responsibilities of how we live together, and the There's a set of teachings that he gave called Saraniya Dhammas, so that they're, say, qualities of communal harmony or of amiability, and they are, say, qualities that lead to, yeah, to amiability, to respect, to harmony, to unity, living together in a skillful way. And as is oftentimes the case in the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha didn't teach in a vacuum. He taught responding to circumstances, and the circumstance at that particular time was the community of monks was not living in harmony. They were not living skillfully. They were, how was it? They were, yeah, they're arguing, was it stabbing each other with verbal daggers or something? The idiom, I mean, it's really, that was quite graphic in that sense. Okay, yeah. They were, it was not exemplary behavior, and the Buddha gathered them together why, you know, what's this all about? What's the point of this? What do you think you're going to gain from that? And then gave a teaching on these six factors of communal harmony, which, as a sidebar, they just ignored and went on quarreling and squabbling until sometime later. But anyway, these are qualities that are worthy of bringing up, particularly at this time, because we're, you know, one, it's a stressful time, it's a difficult time, and also in contact with Ravi, who is organizing the group, and mentioned that the theme, one of the themes that people have been pursuing at the Stanford group lately has been the Brahmaviharas, and this teaching begins with to have actions, bodily actions that are rooted in loving kindness and in metta, and it's kind of salutary. Say both, say in front of the person and behind the person, in the sense that one relates to people with acts of loving kindness, whether the other people are there or not, in the same way of actions of speech and actions of mind. These are the first three conditions that the Buddha points to, and they lead to amiability, lead to harmony, to unity, to respect. And that sense of loving kindness as a foundation is really important, in particular. That this is, these are how one acts, it's how one speaks, it's how one thinks and conceives and articulates feelings within the mind, having them rooted in loving kindness towards oneself, towards others. And And that is say, this aspect of kindness, of gentleness, because it can sometimes devolve into a say an idealizing of you know, we should have all these wonderful thoughts of loving kindness for all beings, and it gets very theoretical and ethereal, and it's important that this is very practical. This is how one conducts one's life, and say in the Buddha's words on loving kindness that we say we chant on a regular basis. It's a discourse that the Buddha gave, and the image that is given as an illustration is when embodies or implements loving kindness, say as a mother protects with her child, her only child. How does one treat a small child, a small baby? It's quite natural in the human condition to wish for their well-being, to look out for them, to care for them, to have a sense of kindness. How do you pick up a little baby? There's definitely a care that's there. It's not like tossing a sack of rice back and forth. I mean, this is a living being, and they're tiny, and they look incredibly vulnerable, and so that one really cares for that. One has gentleness, one has kindness. One really wishes for their well-being. So the illustration is very, very, very apt and appropriate. That's how one engages with each other. And again, a time like this when everybody is kind of stressed, and we ourselves are stressed, and then approaching that with kindness and care, and not approaching it with, say, idealism and views and opinions. I mean, those are not very, they're just not really useful. How the world should be, how we should be, how the society should be. As a thought exercise, it just leads to a lot of misery, but that bringing thoughts of and speech and actions that are based in loving kindness, this is how we get through in a way of harmony and unity and amiability. Human life is tough enough already without having to add to the misery just for the fun of it. See how much more miserable you can make it. I mean, it's not really useful. So that sense of this sense of care, of kindness, gentleness. The other aspect, say the fourth quality that the Buddha points to, are a sense of sharing, sense of sharing, sense of generosity, of giving. The teaching is given to monks, but the principle is is appropriate for anybody. But the way that the Buddha expresses it, that one shares, even if it's the contents of one's alms bowl, just the food that one has been given, received as a monk, that's been given to us, and being willing to share that. So in the same way, that sense of whatever requisites, whatever things that we have, knowing how to share, knowing how to give, knowing how to help out, and there's a bonds of compassion are cultivated again, not through some idealism and a nice thought. It's through the actions that the perceptions that we hold in terms of what can I share, what can I give, how can I help, and that in some ways, right now, one of the ways we can help this social distancing, and it is a way of helping. And there will be those who have the opportunity or the means or the ability, and one hears of it in the media, people kind of brainstorming of how do you make ventilators out of stuff from Home Depot, and how do you get this together? How do we come up with a prototype that can do this and help the healthcare workers, factories that are repurposing, businesses that are repurposing to help provide plastic shields that are gowns that are and that's all ways is like helping these are people are saying, oh, what do I have? And then isn't that their business? Was like I heard of one place, I mean, their business was making little robots for finding leaks in water pipes, and as well as not much of a everything sort of fall, but well, how do we make ventilators? Because they're kind of doers, makers, so making ventilators. And so those are it's examples, and how do we share? How do we with our just with our neighbors, people that are around us? How do we help look after each other? So those are that sense of sharing, of generosity, rather than how can I keep, get and hold on to as much as possible? How can I manipulate the system for my benefit? I mean, it's not really a helpful perspective, it's not a helpful perspective at any time, but at this time it's particularly not helpful and doesn't lead to amiability, to harmony, to respect. So these are that quality of generosity, of sharing. Because you end up recognizing that when you share something with others, it's not just a material exchange. This is an exchange recognition of our mutual humanity and our And that affirms our own humanity. Whereas any kind of separation, any kind of pushing away, any kind of protecting or just reacting out of fear, it really doesn't lift up our own humanity, our own. So that these are just that. Yes, it's not just a material exchange that is important. It's that binding together with the qualities of being a human being, and that is very. I mean, that is a beautiful opportunity. The next quality, the fifth quality that the Buddha taught, is a keeping in common of a standard of virtue and integrity, the idiom that's used is quite beautiful, and it comes over and over again in the suttas, the keeping of the, say a virtue, sila, of that virtue and integrity that's unstained, that's unmottled. But it's also, praised by the wise. Rooted in a kind of non-wavering and leading to concentration or leading to being settled. That's the virtue. From the Buddhist perspective, that is a noble virtue. Keeping a bunch of rules, not so much. But having a commitment to integrity, to harmlessness, to responsibility, having a sense of attunement to what is going to lead to feeling good about one's actions, what's going to lead to a sense of remorse, and that attuning into that, because what we do affects us, and so that sense of a commitment to virtue, commitment to integrity, as that's a because it doesn't, it's not just having some rules that one's given, but it actually has effects. It affects how we, again, the sense of harmony of living together. But then for ourselves, it does lead to the sense of uplift. This is praised by the wise. This is how the wise live. And this is how the mind, the heart, becomes settled. This is how it becomes concentrated and still. And it's interesting that Ajahn Chah, even though he's a great meditation master, he taught meditation. So much of his teaching was about virtue and right view, because that's what really leads the mind to being settled. And of course, and right view is the last quality that the Buddha points to, in the sense that one has this commitment to a view that is in tune with, it's in harmony with with in common with those who are committed to understanding the true nature of things, understanding truth, and that is leads to overcoming of all suffering, of dukkha, leads to freedom. So that the view that leads to more tension, more conflict, more complications in oneself, that's not a view that accords with Dhamma. So that attuning one's view to truth, and truth not just as not just as some ideal or some philosophical bit of knowledge, but what's the result? Where does it take us? Where does it lead us? So that sense of establishing a view that is grounded in truth, grounded in a commitment to freedom from stress, from difficulty, from conflict, from all forms of suffering, external, internal. So that these are the teachings that the Buddha gave for how do we live together as human beings and live in harmony and live for our benefit, our own benefit and the benefit of the whole, the benefit of others. And this is and as I said, the occasion, or one of the occasions when, because this set of teachings comes up in a few places, but there's the place where it comes up most poignantly is the in the middle length discourses, Majjhima 48, and that's where the Buddha addresses the quarreling monks of Kosambi, and I don't think it mentions it in the sutta. The sutta ends with on a kind of a neutral note, but the larger story is in the vinaya Anyway, the monks disregarded the Buddha, went back to their, listened to the talk and listened to the instruction, nodded their heads and went back to their their business of being disharmonious. So that but the Buddha was say compassionate enough to give the opportunity to those people who do want to live in a harmonious way, do want to live in a way of unity and treating each other as in a way that one is able to feel, this kind of protected, because that's some things are really they're not in our control, not within our ability to tweak so that we can get what we want, and we're definitely in a situation like that right now. But we can pay attention to things that we do have a bit of control over. And So that sense of, that attention to loving kindness in actions of body, actions of speech, and the actions of our mind, where we turn that to, quality of sharing, of generosity, attention to the integrity and virtue, and a commitment to establishing a right view of our how we perceive ourselves and the world around us. Because it's easy to look at the world, and the view is either one of horror or fear or what advantage can I get out from this? None of those are really helpful. Or we can look at it in the way, how can we live together as human beings? What are ways as a human can live in a way that we're decreasing suffering for oneself, increasing well-being for oneself, for others, for the whole. And it's an important realization that we have within us the ability because it's easy to wait for conditions to be just right, just perfect, so that if only the world were perfect and everybody got along and the governments did looked after everybody and go on and on and on, then I can be happy. Well, you're like stuck in a Samuel Beckett play, waiting for Godot. And it ain't going to happen. But that sense of recognition what can I do? And this is what the Buddha is. Like, the Buddha is very clear. I mean, it's one of the things that attracted me to Buddhism from the get-go. It seemed like, the Buddha just put all the cards on the table and sort of said, it's like this. This, the world is like this. Human condition is like this. Boop, 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 boop. And here's the tools to deal with it. Go for it. It's because the Buddha doesn't really pull any punches. They say you're born into a condition that fraught with aging, sickness, death, and it doesn't go up from there. those are on the external level. Then we add the sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair to that. So we do. But there are these ways of skillful living. There are these ways of cultivation, there are these ways of understanding where one can weave one's way through these conditions and not be overwhelmed, not be shaken. This is one of the epithets of, say, the the Buddha and awakened beings and disciples of the Buddha who have practiced well is this unshakability, this unshaken quality, sense of not being moved, not being shaken, not being disturbed by the reality of the world, whether it's in its beauties or in its sorrows. And it doesn't mean that they don't feel anything. I think this is of course, my closest example was Ajahn Chah. And there's on a certain level the sense of just incredible unshakability, you know, unmoved. But then on the other side, this tremendous kind of playfulness or enjoyment or delight in the human condition, the delight in seeing things in their true light, and the delight in helping others. So that says these things exist side by side, because usually, you know, from a worldly perspective, it's sort of, if something's going wrong, then one is completely devastated and traumatized by it, and there's storylines that just keep supporting that, and similarly the sense of when things go right, then it's such a cause for exhilaration and exaltation, and part of it is so much as the personalizing, as if it's like something goes wrong and it's a personal failure. Something goes right and it's just a personal accomplishment. And it's just so much of that investing of person, personality, the me, the I, me, mine agenda. And of course that's the problem. When we can look at things in terms of, how is this in accordance with truth? What are the causes and conditions that lead to this? What are the causes and conditions that lead out of this and lead to well-being? And then that's where what the Buddha points to, and you say in this teaching that I gave, as I said, the Buddha is laying out the conditions. And these are the causes and conditions that lead to amiability, to harmony, to unity, to respect, sense of love and kindness, and actions of body, speech, and mind, sharing, generosity, virtue and integrity, discernment, right view, and those are the conditions that we can put in place. It's not really about me or personal accomplishment. It's sort of, this is what's for, leads out of suffering and difficulty, leads to peace and well-being. And of course, I think that's something that we all want as human beings. So those are some reflections for today. I'll close that, and then we'll open it up for questions. Questions coming in?
Not quite yet.
Okay, great. The questions, people are available. It is available. However it's happening, it's magically manifesting on a little piece of plastic glass in front of, over there.
good morning, wishes of good morning to you and to everyone, but no questions as of yet.
Before a question comes in, I'll just give a sense of context of the. As I mentioned, that's the Buddhist community at Stanford who have initiated this, and because I couldn't get down to visit the group, it's happening online. But then also because it's the group requested to have the meeting, and then our own community here, we're hunkered down. There's, 17 monastics, 14 monks, 2 novices, 1 anagarika, who are here, and then there are 8 laymen, laywomen, who are here helping out. They were here for winter retreat and are sheltering in place, and have stayed on to help out. And Debbie's back and forth because of her father, but everybody is doing well. And then today, because normally we've been in the mornings, we would have a work period, but today was an opportunity to do a review of first aid procedures, and so they had a bit of a seminar on how to look after each other. In terms of first aid, and then this started at 9 o'clock. So members of the community, there's about 10 of the monastics here, and there's about 4 or 5 of the lay community who are here. So lots of people get to benefit because of the Stanford group started, and I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other people outside of the Stanford group who are plugging in also. So, yeah, lots of people benefiting from the group's interest.
So we have a question.
Okay.
What is your favorite thing that you've gotten from monastic life?
The favorite thing I've gotten from monastic life. Okay. Well, favorite thing. I mean, I think to look at. I mean, it depends on the mood how one answers. I think one of the things is to be able to look, because I've been a monk now for 45 years or something. I don't know. It's a long time, and but to look back and just say, there's no remorse, no regrets, and that's something that's really delightful. And of course, there's various things that in terms of what I've done and what I've experienced as a monk, the things that I have seen, the people I've had the opportunity to come in contact with, and those are all extraordinary. As within the human experience, to be able to be involved in a lot of truly good things with good people, that is something That's it, really special. But to look back and say, yeah, there's no regret, no remorse, no sense of, oh, I wish I had done something else. And that's just not there. So that's probably in terms of a favorite thing. But then, in terms of thinking about it again, a little bit deeper, just you really get to see the best of the human condition as a monastic, and that's a real treat.
What advice do you have for students or graduates hoping to progress on the noble path towards Nibbana while a student and while in the workplace?
Well, I think one of the things is to just the teaching today is probably a good reflection in terms of as one is a student and one has to be putting forth a lot of effort, and also that sense of I got to make progress. I got to succeed. I've got to. I'd be careful how much that runs one's life, because we can lose sight of the. It's the fundamentals of being a human being, by the. The kind of illusion of progress and success, and then not fulfill ourselves as human beings, as beings who have human qualities of discernment, of wisdom, of compassion, of kindness, of generosity. Those are the things that really, I think, really define what a human life is about. And then, one may or may not get exceptional grades as a success as a student, because you can always be better. That's the illusion of desire, is that you can always be better, and of course even as Buddhist practitioners and even as monastics, that desire program keeps running. In that sense, you can always be better, and you can always make the mind, you should make the mind more peaceful. You should be a better person. There's a seductive quality to that keeps making you miserable. And even if it's like the idiom of that Ajahn Chah, that's right, but it's not true. Whereas, it's true. That's not right in that sense of, always having to be better, having to achieve, having to progress, I'd call into question that agenda and say, well, where is it coming from, and what do I really want to nurture that's going to lead to well-being? I think the teaching today is actually really a good set of teachings for prioritizing what do we bring into our life, either as students, and if you're at Stanford, you already, you're intelligent, you're capable, that's already a part. But can you do that without making yourself miserable? That's a really good way to reflect on it, and you know, okay, and you know, as one goes out into the world to you know, into a career, and to you know, what kind of career do you want to pick up? What's the world actually need? You know, and you know, this is a, and you know, especially at a time of let's say, the great pause, this global pandemic. I mean, it's so, you know, it's a pause to sort of take and reflect and sort of say, yeah, well, what actually is of value? Because it's so unexamined and unreflected on for the most part. What do I actually need? What makes me satisfied, fulfilled? And what is it that is actually a benefit to the world? What's the world need? And you know, we don't need more stuff. We really don't need more stuff. And what ways do we live that's actually, you know, that's sustainable, both in terms of, say, ecologically on the planet level, what's sustainable emotionally? Because that's, you know, one of the great problems of modern society is depression and anxiety. Those are the things that really people really struggle with, so those are to examine. How do we, you know, what's a value? What's actually satisfying? What's meaningful? What's useful? What's beneficial? Both for oneself, but also for others, because we don't live in isolation. We live together as human beings. That's the reality, and learning how to live together skillfully, how to build a society that is responsive and responsible to each other and to itself.
Now there's a few amount of questions filled up. Here, the pandemic has given rise to feelings of profound grief and loss in many of us. How can we best work with these emotions to cultivate well-being for ourselves and others during these times?
Well, I mean, one is to actually examine, because I mean, this is from a Buddhist perspective, you have to really look at grief and loss. Of course, there's, you know, what expectations have we built? What assumptions have we worked on that I've actually lost something? I remember one time, I mean, this is when I was living in Thailand, this person came, and they were very distraught, and immediately were just crying, and he was trying to get out what was wrong, and he had. And he just, his business had failed, and he was had gone bankrupt, and the idiom that is used in the Thai idiom for being, say, bankrupt and kind of like bereft, losing, it's like mot dua, is like. I'm all finished, you know. And I've lost everything. And I said, "What do you mean you've lost everything? you've still got your two arms. You know, some people have accidents, they lose their arms. You've still got your two legs. You've still got your head still on your shoulders. You've got everything you had before you started a business. And you're getting tangled up in the perception of loss, and you built an identity of what. So yeah, obviously this is a time of disruption. I'm not dismissing that, but I think it's really important to reflect on how we built up a sense of who we think we are, what we think the world is, what I have to have in order to be happy, to be fulfilled, and to be able to come back to principles that are much more stable, much more secure, much more real, even. I remember also one time. This was 1997 when the particularly in Asia, man, he got affected. The West, but to a lesser degree, it was an economic collapse, really affected Asia and Thailand in particular. And I was actually in Thailand at that time for a visit, and the economy was unraveling, and people were talking to this person who I know. He had come there to pay respects, and he was very interested in Dhamma, but he was an economist and was actually a former head of the Economic and Social Development Board that set economic policy for Thailand. And people were sort of, of course, everybody's worried, and so they started talking to him about economy and you know, would the economy collapse and what would happen, and then also pointing to like so sort of like, and he said, oh yeah, it's going to collapse. it was just very clear, and he said, well, you know, why is it? It's like America, if we don't have as much debt, America seems to be holding its own right now and staying. And he said, well, you have to realize that, you know, money is not, it's not about debt, it's not about money, it's about perception. It's about how it's perceived. It was really interesting. It's like a whole, you know, even on a global economy, it's not, yes, obviously there's some very real things, but it's also in terms of, if you believe in something, it helps to prop it up. So it's like America, and this has been going on for some, people believe America's economy will keep going, so it does keep going. And we'll see how long it'll, I mean, at some point it's, and this is a time when it's, I think it'll definitely be shaken. But yeah, these are some things that are, you know, what we invest in as perceptions of ourselves, of the world, and how things function is really worthy of reviewing, especially in terms of say, as a having a Buddhist practice. You know, the Buddha's given us the tools. What is it that's actually going to provide some sense of say, unshakability? Where does our unshakability come from? Where does our stability come from?
Apart from social distancing, what are other ways that we could behave compassionately during this time when there's so much physical distance between us?
Well, I think one of the ways is starting to think creatively in ways that we can be generous, we can be sharing what we have, and looking towards, and especially nowadays with say information online, how you know, what can we, who can we be connecting with, how can we be connecting with certain causes or movements or people that are trying to do something good, something beneficial, how can we support that? And I think that's really important, because that I think one of the things where, in terms of grief and loss, is oftentimes there's a grief of and loss in terms of agency. And so to be proactive in thinking, well, what are ways that we can be, what can we be supporting, what we can be helping, what can we be, what can I be sharing? Some kind, either some skill or some resources that one has, in order to help others. Because yeah, lots of people. There's lots of people who don't have the resources, or there's lots of things that are needed right now, and it takes. It doesn't necessarily mean a physical presence, but there's one can be helping out in different ways. Different skills that one has can be shared.
In your guiding meditation, you mentioned noticing this is bearable. I wonder if you can speak to when it's skillful to bear with, and when it's skillful to put effort towards change, whether in action or in the mind.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because it's sometimes we, because that's where discernment, wisdom is really important, because we can get into. I mean, it is important to sort of reflect. Okay, I can bear with this, because sometimes the feeling of my mind's all over the place, or this is just really difficult, or this is really awful, and it feels like it's unbearable. And then, but then when we look at it a bit more closely, you just, this is bearable. I can be with this. But then, there is a point where one just keeps bearing with it, it's like, sitting with knee pain until one has to have an operation. I mean, I know people who've done that. They've been put up with the pain. Or there's example I've used a long time of the horse in Animal Farm. The pigs take over, and the horses, they just find more work for him. And his mantra is, "I will work harder. I will work harder. I will work harder." So yeah, I'll bear with this. I'll bear with this. And then he dies. Yeah. So that's not so useful. there's a level of discernment. I'm saying, what is? Because I think that's one of the things the Buddha is couching things is not in absolutes of, this is good and this is bad, or this is right and this is wrong. But in that sense, that perspective of kusala and akusala, skillful, unskillful, wholesome, unwholesome, beneficial, unbeneficial, useful, not useful. That's a really important way of viewing and looking at things that helps one to not get trapped into it. So like, I'm bearing with this, but it's actually not very useful. It's really not very beneficial. How do I adjust this? How do I do something new and different? How do I approach it in a completely fresh way? So those are looking at things from a perspective of how the Buddha, that sense of it's not sort of right and wrong, good or bad. It's that skillful, unskillful, beneficial, unbeneficial, useful, not wholesome, unwholesome. These are, and those are mutable. Those you have to really tune in and pay attention, because it has a spectrum of experience, and like the that sense of kusala and akusala. It says, does it lead to increased well-being or decreased well-being? Does it lead to increased clarity, or does it cloud the mind? Does it lead to a sense of sense of stability or sense of instability? So these are there's, one has to be willing to investigate some nuances or some shades of experience, and that's sometimes we don't want to do well. Just tell me if it's right or it's wrong. I want to know, is it black or is it white? Just don't give me this gray stuff. But a lot of human experience is not on those absolute spectrums. They're learning how to tune in to the nuances of our mind and of the world around us.
How do we deal with a world full of views and opinions?
Please don't add to them. I mean, that's and don't think because you don't have a view, or you're not sort of out there expressing your views and opinions, that somehow you're a failure or you're stupid. I mean the world is it's got enough people willing to express their views and opinions. Again, that sense of being willing to tune into, because that's what views and opinions. People want absolutes, and to be willing to reflect on the spectrum of experience. Also, learning how to pay attention to, because views and opinions tend to lock things into discrete experiences rather than paying attention to processes. And as a if we're going to follow the Buddha's advice and live according to his principles, we have to be willing to pay attention to the processes, pay attention to the nuances, pay attention to the spectrums of experience. And sometimes, it's not absolutely clear. And you just have to be comfortable with that not knowing sometimes. I don't know yet. And having a fixed view or a strong view doesn't actually make the knowing any clearer. To me, it just clouds it even more. So that sense of, there's a sense of honesty of saying, I don't know yet. There's a teaching that Ajahn Chah used to quote praise, and it's a It's a story of the, say, the Buddha giving a teaching, and then and then the Buddha asking, after he's finished giving the teaching to the community, then he asks Sariputta, what do you think of this teaching? You know, do you approve or disapprove? Is it right or wrong? Sariputta said, I don't know. So in a sense, because I haven't reflected on it yet, I haven't put it into practice yet, and it's not that Sariputta showing disrespect to the Buddha, well, I don't really believe it yet. No, it's just I don't know yet. It needs to be put into practice. So that sense, you know, is the Buddha asking, do you believe in this teaching or not? And you say, well, I don't know. It needs some more investigation and more practice. And, and the Buddha praised, saying that that's how it should be. So it isn't a matter of believing in something, because that's usually what beliefs are, views and opinions are basically just something that props up another belief system, and it's not usually so helpful or fruitful.
Is there time for another one? In what way are qualities and defects also quote unquote viral? Are right perception, right speech, right thought, right action also viral?
Yeah, I would say so. I think the what comes to mind, of course, is 24 years ago, there was nothing here. There was no monastery, no monks. No community. Well, the community was a bit scattered in the Bay Area. There's a few people, but then Ajahn Amaro showed up. Then I showed up, and slowly it's gone viral. there's been more and more monastics, more lay people. So it's the spread of a good idea. You think of the 25 years ago. Yeah, there was interest in Buddhism, there was interest in mindfulness, but those ideas are really spreading. What is good, what is wholesome, what is beneficial, is also something that spread, because it has a different effect on the human condition. It's something that we all long for. We are hardwired to prefer to be, say, to be happy than to be miserable. We're hardwired to be, to appreciate a certain peace rather than agitation. It's just something that we prefer. We prefer trust. In a human relationship, we want to draw close to people we feel we can trust, rather than people who are we feel unsafe around. We feel it's not this is not a trustworthy being. You know, one doesn't want to close. So it's quite natural as a human being. So that those qualities, and I think that's why it's important to, again, to making this process more conscious, making it something that we attend to a bit more closely, understanding how that works, understanding how it affects us, so that we can, because it's, you know, it's the, you know, one of the banes of the human condition is that we know what's right or what's true. So, but one more thing. I just got to do this, and you know, we get distracted, and so that being able to look after that caring for a sense of focus and attention, awareness, so that we can maintain our commitment to cultivation, to development. Then it's something that is a benefit to ourselves. It's a benefit to others. It affects others. Maybe one more question.
Okay. At one point in your talk, you mentioned that ruminating on how one would like to change the world or the conditions around oneself can be a source of needless suffering. At the same time, it seems that there are times when one does want to work to change the world or how one's society is organized for the sake of loving kindness and alleviating suffering. For instance, in the case of social injustice or abuse, how do we engage with those desires for change in a skillful way?
I think one is that and absolutely one wants to be attending to it, but it's also attending to it skillfully. And I think one of the things is reflecting on causes and conditions, because it's so seeing processes rather than, because one of the things that is really toxic is setting oneself up in terms of, say, me and other, that division of me and other, putting oneself in opposition. And it's not just me individual, it's me and my group, and against that other group. And so that is a source of division. But when you start reflecting on the processes of within a society the condition, what is it that's underlying, and how can one both be attuned to the humanity of people who are in need, but also the humanity of people who are the cause of the problem. How do we get through that? It doesn't mean that one doesn't understand or pay attention to it, or one dismisses it. But it's more like, because there's so much, kind of righteous indignation, so much, and people feel that you should be nourished by anger and indignation. And it really doesn't, if one's going to commit oneself to change, one has to get used to looking at things from a big perspective, and a perspective of how do we include rather than exclude? Because the reality is, as human beings, we're there isn't any other realm. There isn't any other world. How do we make it work so that those principles of loving kindness, it doesn't exclude. It doesn't mean one excuses or one doesn't recognize unskillfulness. It's really important to identify it clearly. But you want to pay attention to processes. And then you have to, like, drawing in more people. When I lived in Thailand, coming to America, it's a different society, different opportunity, different responsibilities. And I haven't been engaged directly with the sort of social movement so much. In Thailand, I had much more contact and projects that were very much in terms of social engagement. And one of the things that I learned was that you want to approach a particular problem with as open a mind as possible, and then see who it is might be willing to help, might be able to help. And sometimes it's really surprising. I did a lot of environmental work, but then it's also, if you're going to do environmental work, you need to do social development, because you can't separate the two. And so then finding projects for people's livelihoods or bettering their quality of life. Sometimes I was working with the military. Never thought I'd work with the military. I've worked with some of the politicians. But if you put people into categories and don't recognize them as other human beings, then you end up separating and still end up in the causes of division. But there are the NGO that I set up years ago, it's still functioning, it's still committed, and because it's been around for a long time now, it does a lot of work in teaching and training other NGOs how to work, supporting other NGOs. So I think that sense of just not being too idealistic, not separating, not dividing, and looking for people opportunities that will able to work together for this certain principle of and according to these causes and conditions, and that can change. So it's being willing to be fluid. So that's 10:59. It's the end of our session. Our meal time is coming up at 11 o'clock. I'd just like to thank the Buddhist community at Stanford for helping to organize this and to set it up, and I hope it's been useful and beneficial. And maybe we can, just as a close and as a blessing, we could have our community chant the Buddha's words on loving kindness as a way to wrap it up, and my own and the community here at Abhaya Giri, extend our warm wishes and hopes that people keep keep safe, keep healthy, and look after each other.